Module 6 is going to cover neurological disorders. We're going to start by just talking about a general neuro assessment for children. So one thing that's important to know for your neuro assessment for kids is that children under 2 years of age can require a special evaluation because they can't respond to our normal directions, our normal questions that we would evaluate a neurological assessment with. So a lot of it is going to be observation and input from the parents. We're going to be assessing normal growth and development parameters, such as the size and shape of their head. We're going to be discussing with the parents their evaluation of their child, asking them if this is normal behavior for them, if it is out of the ordinary. Looking at developmental milestones. Are they reaching that cognitive function that they're supposed to be reaching at that age? Also, we're going to be taking a detailed history from the parents, such as a prenatal history, depending on the age of the child. Was the child exposed to any drugs or alcohol while mom was pregnant? Did mom experience any infections? Also, taking a birth history. Was it a traumatic birth? Were there any complications that could have deprive the child of oxygen from the brain? And then also looking at a postnatal history. Has the child suffered any injuries, any head injuries, or had any illnesses that would affect neurological function? Any febrile illnesses, febrile seizures, and so forth. We are going to be assessing their behavior. Looking at personality, assessing their affect, their mood. Do they have a flat affect? Is it normal for them? Their level of activity. Are they meeting those milestones again? A one-year-old shouldn't just be laying in the crib staring at the ceiling. They should be meeting those milestones, walking, getting into stuff, learning to talk. We'll be assessing social interaction and attention span. Do they interact with the people around them, with other children? Are they really irritable? Do their verbal skills meet the milestones that they're supposed to be at? Assessing motor function. Looking at their muscle, the size of the muscles, the tone and strength. Do they have good muscle tone? Are their grips equal? Do they have any abnormal movements, such as twitching or tripping and falling when they're walking? That's not normal for a child. Looking at their activity and coordination as well. When we're looking at sensory function, can they tell the difference between a sharp and a dull object if you're touching them with them, between the cotton swab, the alcohol pad, and assessing those cranial nerves, looking to make sure that their reflexes are intact. The first disorder we're going to talk about is increased intracranial pressure. And there's some different causes for increased intracranial pressure. It can be caused by anything that's taking up space, such as a lesion, a tumor. When those are in there, it's caused taking up space that the brain should be. So it's going to cause the pressure to go up. There can be an accumulation of fluid within the ventricle system, such as hydrocephalus. They could have a bleed from a head injury or a torn vessel. Can also be caused by edema of cerebral tissues, which can be from shaken baby syndrome, or an infection such as meningitis. Early signs and symptoms of ICP can be subtle in the beginning and can assume many patterns. As the pressure increases, the signs and symptoms become more pronounced. The first alteration that you're going to notice is level of consciousness. They're going to have an altered level of consciousness as that pressure goes up. It's the earliest indicator of change in the neurological status. We're going to be assessing alertness, Can they be aroused when they're sleeping? Do they have the ability to respond to stimuli? We're also going to be assessing cognitive abilities. Can they process stimuli? Do they have impaired decision making? Can they produce the normal verbal and motor responses that we want them to do? Some signs and symptoms of increased intracranial pressure is the lack of painful stimuli, which is extremely abnormal, and we need to report that immediately. As the pressure increases, their level of consciousness will decrease. Irritability, extreme irritability in a child is a very early warning sign of the pressure going up. So we need to make sure that we're paying attention to it. As far as vital signs go, the pulse may vary. It can be rapid or it can be slow, depending on the stage of the increased intracranial pressure. A late sign of ICP is bradycardia. So as the pressure goes up, the heart rate will go up to a certain point, and then it's going to start going down as that pressure gets to be too much. Respirations. Respirations are going to start slowing and become irregular due to the pressure on the brainstem, which is going to control that respiratory function. Temperature. Temperature can be elevated, especially with infections and intracranial bleeding. But if the increased intracranial pressure is caused by a toxic origin, such as poisoning, it can make the temperature go down. Pupils. We're going to be assessing the size and reactivity of the pupils. Okay, pinpoint pupils are indicative of brainstem dysfunction. We're going to be assessing to see if they're responding bilaterally or unilaterally. We're looking at the size. Sudden, fixed, and dilated pupils is a neurological emergency, and we need to report it. We are also going to be assessing neuromuscular movements, looking at the strength and spontaneous movements. We're going to be assessing to see if their movements are symmetrical or asymmetrical. We're also assessing muscle tone. We want to know if it's increased or decreased or normal, and looking to see if they have any tremors or spasms. Another factor that we're going to be assessing in increased intracranial pressure is their positioning and posturing. So two different things that we will be looking at is decorticate position and decerebrate positioning and posturing. Decorticate is adduction and flexion, where decerebrate is rigid extension and pronation. Decorticate posturing is usually a cerebral cortex dysfunction, and it's due to severe dysfunction of the brain. Okay, decerebrate is more mid-level of brain, such as a medullary injury. Both of them are abnormal and reportable to the physician. Okay, so how are we going to diagnose if they have increased intracranial pressure? One thing they're going to look at is a lumbar puncture. Okay, they can measure the amount of pressure within that cerebral spinal fluid cavity, and they can sample the fluid for analysis. They can also do a subdural tap to rule out subdural effusions. It also relieves the increased intracranial pressure because it allows the brain to expand into that area that they did the tap. They can do an EEG, which measures electrical activity and detects abnormalities. They can do that to determine brain death. They will also do that to determine seizure activity. They can do a CAT scan as well, which is going to allow them to visualize horizontal and vertical cross sections of the brain. An MRI allows them to do tissue discrimination so that they can tell if there's a tumor or something in there. There's also transillumination, which is a localized glowing seen in abnormal fluid. I've never seen transillumination done. They usually do a CT or an MRI. Okay, some labs that they're going to be doing. They will be assessing the CSF fluid to determine if there's any infection going on. They can look at a blood glucose level. The reason they're checking a blood glucose level is when we're hypo or hyperglycemic, it affects our neurological status. We need to know if we have, if our patient has an altered level of consciousness due to something going on neurologically, or if there's something else going on. If they have an altered blood sugar and we can fix that, that will fix the neuro problem. Also, the same thing for electrolytes, assessing calcium, magnesium, and sodium. Because alterations in those can cause neurological problems, they can also cause seizures. They will be assessing clotting studies to see if maybe our patient has a clot and that's what's causing the altered level of consciousness, or they're not clotting and they could be having a bleed. They will be assessing liver function tests. The liver function test is important because if the liver's not functioning and ammonia is building up, it can cause encephalitis, which will lead to altered level of consciousness. Assessing blood cultures and drug titers. And not just drug titers for prescription drugs, but drug titers for illicit drugs as well. Okay, the next disorder we're going to be talking about is head injury. So head injury in children can be from a lot of different things. The first etiology we're going to talk about is falls. Okay, children are very curious. They can be very clumsy at times and they don't listen very well. So they fall down a lot. They fall out of trees, they fall off the bed. So that's a major cause of head trauma. Also, motor vehicle accidents, bicycles, skateboards, all of those wonderful things that kids like to do. Another reason that they can have head trauma is their head is larger and heavier in proportion to their body than an adult. So when they do fall, that's typically the thing that hits first is their head. They're very curious. Like I said, they get into everything. They're climbing and jumping, and they have incomplete motor development. So while they're curious and trying all of this new stuff, they aren't coordinated enough to prevent themselves from getting hurt. So they trip, they fall down, and usually fall face first. Okay, so what we will be assessing out of all of that is to see if they have a concussion, if they have a contusion and laceration, or they can have a fracture, such as a skull fracture, in different areas of the skull, depending on what part hits. Shaken baby syndrome is also another disorder for neurological problems. What happens in shaken baby syndrome that causes so much damage is as they're being shaken, their brain is smashing into the front of the skull as well as the back. So it's causing injuries in more than one part of the brain. And when that's happening, the other issue is as the brain is being shaken, it's tearing vessels inside of itself. So there's lots of bleeding, which causes increased intracranial pressure, and there's lots of bruising to the brain. Okay, the next disorder we're going to talk about is meningitis. Meningitis is an infection which causes inflammation of the meninges. It is spread by vascular dissemination. It can be caused by otitis media, an upper respiratory tract infection that then gets put into the blood to the vascular system and disseminates into the cerebral spinal fluid. What happens is they have an exudate that covers the brain, and the brain becomes hyperemic and edematous because of the infection. There's an inflammation and an increased white blood cell count that accumulates, causing tissue damage. Okay, some of the causative organisms of meningitis. It can be viral, it can be caused by TB, or it can be bacterial. Okay, so some of the organisms, H. influenza type B, which doesn't happen very often anymore because we now have the HIV or HIV vaccine that children are being immunized with. S. pneumoniae and N. meningitis or meningococcus. 95% of all of the bacterial cases are caused by the S. pneumoniae or N. meningitis for kids. So some of the signs and symptoms, they usually have a very abrupt onset. It's not something that takes place over a couple of days that they start getting sick. These kids usually wake up and are sick, and it's very abrupt and very quick. So some of the signs and symptoms are fever of unknown origin, lethargy, irritability. For an infant, the irritability isn't the normal fussiness or grouchiness. It's usually a very high-pitched cry because they're in pain. Vomiting and or diarrhea. Signs of meningeal irritation, which include headache, can include seizure activity, arching their back. They also have guarding of the neck. They get what they call nuchal rigidity, a very stiff neck. They don't want to turn their head. It hurts them to put their head up and down. And they cry when you try and move it because it's really tender and very painful for them. Okay, poor feeding is also a sign of meningitis. Okay, labs. So how are we going to figure out if our patients have meningitis? The first thing they're going to do is a lumbar puncture. We're going to look at that CSF fluid. They're going to look at it for a culture. They're going to be assessing the glucose and the protein level in them. Okay. They're assessing those two things partly to help determine if it's a bacterial or a viral infection. So if our glucose level is low in the CSF fluid, it's indicative of a bacterial infection because the bacteria are consuming and eating that glucose. Okay, if the protein is elevated, it can also be indicative of a bacterial infection because the bacteria are changing the permeability of the cells, and it makes the protein leak into the CSF fluid. Okay, they are going to be analyzing the cell count and then also doing a Gram stain to see what is growing in that fluid. Okay, they're going to be doing blood cultures to rule out sepsis, also a urine culture to rule out a UTI. They're going to do a chemistry panel to look at those electrolytes, glucose, and kidney function. Okay, so what are we going to do about our patients with meningitis? First thing that they're going to do is start antibiotics. And they're going to administer those antibiotics within 1 hour of diagnosis of this patient of meningitis. Okay, it's extremely important that these antibiotics get on board, because if we don't start treating that meningitis and it is bacterial, our patient is going to suffer major consequences. Okay, they go downhill very quickly if we don't get those antibiotics on board. The type of antibiotic is based on the age and causative organism. Okay, so for neonate, their choices are going to be ampicillin and clathrin. Okay, for 3 months to 3 years of age, they're going to use ampicillin and ceftriaxone. Older children is going to be more that penicillin and chloramphenicol. Okay, they choose these antibiotics to, they're based on what the patient's body can tolerate at that age, and also by the most common causative organism for meningitis in those age groups. Okay, now let's say that the cultures come back in 24 hours and our patient, it's showing that they probably have viral meningitis. They will stop the antibiotics, but they will not wait for those cultures to come back before they start them, because by then it could be too late and our patient is going to have residual effects and possibly brain damage and even possible death. So they will start the antibiotics immediately. Okay, another treatment option that we're going to be looking at is fluid management. Now, there's a very fine line in fluid management that we have to be concerned with between dehydration and cerebral edema. The child could be dehydrated due to vomiting and diarrhea and their poor appetite, but if we give too much fluid too fast, it will cause a shift in the electrolytes in and out of the cells and can cause cerebral edema. Cerebral edema in our patients with meningitis who are already having meningeal irritation and increased intracranial pressure will make the problem worse for our patients. So it's possible that the physician will put them on 2/3 maintenance rate instead of their 24-hour maintenance because we don't want that fluid shift. Depending on the level of increased intracranial pressure, they could also be on a fluid restriction because we just don't want the pressure to get any higher. Okay, so potential complications for meningitis. PC neurological dysfunction. Looking at cerebral hypoxia, seizures, and increased intracranial pressure. They are also at risk for seizure and high risk for spread of infection. So those patients with meningitis are going to be on isolation for the first 24 hours of antibiotic therapy. After that, they aren't considered contagious anymore and can come off isolation. Okay, another nursing diagnosis for meningitis is fluid volume deficit. So they are at risk for fluid volume deficit because they could be NPO or have a fluid restriction. We're going to be looking at I's and O's, daily weights, assessing their labs, such as their specific gravity of their urine and electrolyte levels, and then also monitoring their IV fluids. We're going to be doing careful, conservative IV fluid replacement to fix that fluid volume deficit. Another PC diagnosis is neurological damage from the seizures or sequelae to meningitis. Okay, so they could have hydrocephalus, they can have visual or hearing deficits, and they can have a seizure disorder. Okay, the visual and hearing deficits could be permanent damage due to increased intracranial pressure from the meningitis. Okay, so important factors about meningitis to remember is antibiotic treatment within an hour. You're going to be assessing for signs of increased intracranial pressure, monitoring fluid status, and trying to prevent those potential complications from ICP. Okay, the next disorder that we are going to be talking about is Reye syndrome. Reye syndrome is toxic encephalopathy with additional organ involvement. involvement. Etiology, it normally follows a viral illness such as the flu or chickenpox with administration of aspirin. Okay, that is one of the reasons that we don't give aspirin to children on a general basis, because it can cause Reye syndrome if it's given with these other viral illnesses. Okay, so signs and symptoms of Reye syndrome: fever, decreased level of consciousness, they get very lethargic, they can slip into a coma, and then also hepatic dysfunction, which can cause increased ammonia levels, which can turn into neurological problems because it can lead to encephalitis. Okay, the prognosis is good. Okay, if they find out that the patient has Reye syndrome, they do have a good prognosis because they can treat it. The major thing for Reye syndrome is we want to prevent it from ever happening. So we don't give children aspirin unless there is a disease process that absolutely indicates that they have to have it. Okay, the next disorder that we're going to be talking about is febrile seizures. Hey, febrile seizures. Most common age for that is between 6 months and 3 years. I think your book may say all the way up to 5 years. I'm not very particular about the actual age range. Just know that it's most common in young children. For the occurrence, it's a seizure accompanied by a fever without an underlying CNS infection. So it's not caused by meningitis or an increased intracranial pressure, anything like that. Okay, it usually occurs during the temperature rise. So as the fever is going up, that's when they would have the seizure. Okay, treatment options. We're going to treat the fever by giving Tylenol or ibuprofen. Okay, if it becomes necessary that we have to treat the seizure because it's not stopping on its own, the treatment option for a child is going to be Ativan, is the most common one. Okay, as the patient is having the seizure, there's a few assessment things that we need to be looking at. The type of seizure that the patient is having. Is it a tonic-clonic seizure? Is it just a tonic seizure? Okay, the tonic is the stiff, very stiff muscles. The clonic is the jerking movement. So we need to be aware of what type of seizure they're having. And then put them in the rescue position if they are having a seizure. Okay, we're going to be implementing seizure precautions if we know our patient is coming in for febrile seizures or any other seizure disorder. Okay, emergency treatment. You're going to put them in the rescue position. We're going to protect them from injury. We're going to open their airway so that they maintain that patent airway. And then accurately observe and record the happening. So what type of seizure they were having, what their vital signs were when it started and throughout the seizure, looking at their O2 saturation and making sure that that doesn't drop. Okay, so for febrile seizures, the most important thing is we need to treat the fever. When the fever goes away, the seizures will stop and they will go away. The next disorder that we're looking at is hydrocephalus. Okay, hydrocephalus is an abnormal condition characterized by an increased volume of cerebrospinal fluid under increased pressure within the intracranial cavity. Okay, so if there's too much fluid, it's going to make the pressure go up because it's in a confined space. There's three possible mechanisms that can lead to hydrocephalus. The first is they have an overproduction of CSF fluid. The second cause can be a defective absorption of CSF fluid. And the third is obstruction of the CSF fluid. Okay, there's three major causes for obstruction of CSF. One is inflammation. Another is congenital malformations. And the last one is a tumor that's blocking the CSF from being able to drain.